Please be seated. There is one hearing this morning in two cases, numbers 2012-1015 and 2012-1016. The appellant is the property owner. Mr. Gill, please present your argument.
It pleased the Master Commissioner. I would like to begin with a limited history of the case, as we believe that relates directly to our argument. The case began when the Board of Education filed a 2006 complaint based upon a transfer of the properties, and there are multiple properties. On August 1st, 2006, the complaint was filed to increase the values of all the sites that were part of the transaction up to the reported transaction price. The cases were all heard
on... The transaction then was the 2006 sale as opposed to the 2005 sale.
Yes, sir. Okay. Yes, sir. Two transactions, 2005 and then 2006. And the Board of Education's complaints were predicated upon the 2006 transfer. The hearings were held November 26, 2007. And at the Board of Revision, the new owner, U. Storrett, presented testimony of the general counsel, Ms. Kathleen Wigan, of the buyer, U. Storrett. And at the time, she presented testimony that, in her opinion, the sale was not arm's length. The purchase and sale agreements were presented. They are part of the record and in the supplement. And the seller of the property was the Jernigan Property Group. The buyer of the property, U. Storrett, who had recently hired a new CFO, the same Dean Jernigan, who had been the owner of the Jernigan Property Group. He had been the principal of the Jernigan Property Group. At the hearing, the appellant also presented a 10-Q of U. Storrett. That was a 10-Q that was filed with the Securities and Exchange Commission on March 31st, 2007, and it listed the sale as a related party transaction. Additionally, General Counsel Ms. Wigan testified that Mr. Jernigan was required to execute a non-compete covenant, which is also in the supplement and attached to the purchase agreement, in connection with his employment as president and CFO of the appellant, U. Storrett. In the agreement, he agreed not to expand his beneficial interest in the facilities being purchased. At the time of the hearing, the Board of Revision decision did not reflect any increase in value to the 2006 transfer, but did reflect an increase in value to the 2005 sale. The Board of Education then appealed all the decisions to the Board of Tax Appeals.
Let me ask for a clarification of that. I guess my understanding was that the Board of Revision adopted the 2005 allocated sale prices that were reported on the conveyance fee statements for 2006. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
They ignored the 2006 transaction but utilized the 2005 transaction, ostensibly finding that the sales were either not arm's length or not reflective of market value. The record itself does not specifically state their reason for rejecting the 2006 transfer.
Let me ask you about the record for a second, because there were, as you say, several properties sold as part of the sale, and there was one apparently out in Reynoldsburg. And there was a Reynoldsburg case that was apparently settled at this court, but some of the record that was in the Reynoldsburg case was then put into the record of the present case. Is that right?
That's correct.
And does that includes a lot of these agreements that you're referring to, the sale agreements and so forth?
Right. It's one agreement, and it covers all nine properties.
Okay.
So all the facts and data and information presented for all the cases is exactly the same.
And the BTA makes mention of the BOR hearing testimony. that was given in the Reynoldsburg case is being considered by the BTA in this case. Is that also part of the record in this case?
I'm not sure if that's part of the record. I know that I personally attended the Board of Revision hearing, and they were all consolidated for the purposes of hearing. There was really one hearing. So the record is probably exactly the same. The Board of Education appealed the case to the Board of Tax Appeals. Both parties waived hearing, and the Board of Tax Appeals decided the case upon the record. There was no additional evidence submitted by either party. It was briefed, and the Board of Tax Appeals increased the value to the transfers indicated at 2006, and the appeal before you today ensued. And I'd like to direct the Master Commissioner to our law and argument on page 2 of our brief. Our proposition of law number 1, all elements of an arm's length sale must be present for a sale to be used for assessment purposes. And that covers our assignment of errors 1 through 5. And it is our argument that the transaction itself was reported to the Securities and Exchange Commission under Section 8 of the 10Q under related party transactions. And I think it's important in our supplement at page 15, we've enclosed a copy of the 10Q that was submitted to the Board of Revision. And Section 8, related party transactions, underneath says acquisition of facilities, and it lists the specifics. And the key sentence would be the first. The company, in accordance with the contract signed on April 3rd, 06, acquired 9 self-storage facilities from Jernigan Property Group on July 27, 2006 for consideration of approximately $45.3 million. Our president and chief executive officer, Dean Jernigan, serves as president of Jernigan Property Group and has a 20% beneficial interest in one self-storage facility partially owned by Jernigan Property Group and related companies and partnerships. I stress the "and" because in the Board of Tax Appeals decision, which is included in the record, on page 9, the Board of Tax Appeals, and I quote, "The board finds that Mr. Jernigan's relationship to the seller was limited in scope, constituting a minimal interest in one of the 9 storage facilities purchased." And I believe that is a misnomer just by virtue of reading what is listed here. Again, partially owned by Jernigan Property and related companies and partnerships, as well as just behind the 10Q, there is the purchase and sale agreement of all the sites, and Mr. Jernigan signed on behalf of all of the entities. So I believe that error itself is enough for reversal, because the Board of Tax Appeals is relying on the fact that they believe Mr. Jernigan's relationship to be limited in scope with minimal interest in one facility.
Well, the issue here then is the arm's length character of the sale. Now, is that an issue of fact or an issue of law?
Well, we believe it to be an issue of law, and we have included various authority. Now, there's no Ohio authority specific to the treatment of SEC or AICPA or accounting standards or the FASB standards, but we know that we use those in Ohio for many of the other taxes, personal property tax, other types of write-ups and acquisitions and closings and GAAP. Those are important parts of everyday business. And the SEC, and we've spent a lot of time researching and putting into our brief how the SEC began, what their duties are, and I think it's unfair to ignore that authority, and the BTA at this point is ignoring related party transactions. On its very face, a related party transaction may not be arm's length.
Well, wouldn't the argument on the other side be that the BTA didn't ignore it, they considered it, and they're the fact finder, and they determined as a matter of fact that it had not been shown that the sale was not at arm's length?
Well, I believe the BTA has erred by finding that Mr. Jernigan's relationship was limited in scope It constituted minimal interest in one of nine storage facilities, which that is not what the specific guidance indicates, nor the purchase agreements, and these were all submitted and testified to at the Board of Revision.
So you're asserting that the BTA has actually mischaracterized what the evidence actually is?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we believe they're ignoring important guidance. Now, there is no Ohio guidance, as I stated before, and part of the reason is because we believe the issue is so on the face, easy to interpret, that there wouldn't be any case law working the other way. In my exhaustive research, I was unable to find anywhere where related party transaction itself was defined. In my years of practice, I have not seen a related party transaction treated as arm's length unless additional evidence were either deemed appropriate, presented, or addressed. In this case, the Board of Education took the appeal, and the only evidence that they are presenting is the conveyance fee statement and the deed, which ordinarily, I believe, would be enough to shift the burden. We believe we've shifted the burden at the Board of Revision by presenting evidence, by presenting testimony, by showing the ownership interest on both sides, by providing the SEC guidance that calls this a related party transaction. And we think we've shifted the burdens.
So you agree that the initial burden then, when there's the conveyance fee statement as evidence of the sale, was upon the owner to controvert the arm's length character of the sale. But part of your argument is that you presented enough evidence to put a burden on the other side.
That is our argument. We believe that we've shifted the burden by the presentation of purchase agreement, the SEC guidance itself, and I don't believe one needs to be an expert in accounting, appraisal, to really understand. Even a layperson can look at something as simple as a 10Q and a 10K and say, this is listed as a related party transaction. These are important documents that all of us rely on. They're reported to the public. That's how we decide whether or not we like a company, we want to buy stock. It's a public company that is audited, and they themselves have deemed this to be a related party transaction. And we have defined what the AICPA calls related party transactions, and all of these governing bodies have listed that it calls into nature the arm's length nature of a transaction. We believe that the Board of Education on appeal had the opportunity to request additional evidence, to depose witnesses, to seek out specific allocations or reasons for allocations, and do more once the burden had been shifted. And the Board of Revision accepted only the 2005 sale and rejected the 2006 sale. We understand that the hearing is de novo, but we believe that we have presented evidence, and it's the same evidence. There's nothing new to the record. The only new information that we've presented is the easily attainable guidance on what is a related party transaction and how do we govern it. And we're not asking for any kind of preemption from federal law or SEC guidance or AICPA. We're looking for guidance and reliance upon guidance that all public companies have to utilize.
Let me ask you about what the relief would be. If would it be appropriate for the court to reverse, or would there be some possibility that it would be appropriate for the court to remand for consideration of some of the evidence, perhaps, that the BTA did not consider?
I think in this case, the Board of Education has had their opportunity to rebut the related party transaction and has not utilized it. So we think a reversal. We don't think there's an opportunity for remand here because all the evidence is in the record and it has been addressed and it has been mischaracterized by the Board of Tax Appeals, and we're asking for reversal.
Okay.
I'd like to reserve a minute or two for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Gill. Mr. Rich.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Jeffrey Rich on behalf of the Hilliard City Schools Board of Education and the Southwestern City Schools Board of Education. We see three issues to discuss this morning. The first one, which was notably missing, was the doctrine of waiver. Now, if this is such an important case with so many great issues, how in the world could their BTA brief not be one page, but one paragraph? One paragraph. And we cite cases where we don't, of course, want the Supreme Court, nor do you want the Supreme Court to become the super BTA, but that's apparently what they want here because they, we believe, waived all their claims by not putting together a decent brief and raising all these issues.
Well, doesn't, I mean, the, at least the one paragraph, doesn't it mention the arm's length issue in the case?
So why do we have briefs at all? I mean, we had hearings, all the stuff's in the record. Why bother briefing? You know, forget about the brief. Number two, though, let's talk about the routine nature of this sale, because that's all it was. Nine properties, one document, each sale identified, each price negotiated. They make the outrageous claim that this is different than a routine sale. They say because of this form 10Q filed with the federal government that that's dispositive of all arm's length sale transaction issues. And they say that merely by reporting, they use the word reporting, disclosing, or identifying on the 10Q, that that's sufficient to show that they were related parties and they did not act at arm's length just by disclosing and saying it. That's sort of like me telling the court, well, you know, this sale's not arm's length, so because the parties were related, that ends it. I don't have to present any more evidence. Well, that's not the way it goes. But then they cleverly go on to the next step and they say, the actual facts don't show that it's arm's length, and there's no facts that even suggest it's not arm's length. The facts prove the exact opposite. The parties were not related in any fashion at the time the sale was consummated, the documents were signed, and the prices were negotiated, and the prices never changed, even though this fella, like in so many other transactions, if you have a good operator, bring them on board to the new company so you don't screw it up. But nothing changed after that. In fact, they had the trustees of the buyer company, who were, as they described them, independent, approve the agreement. Now, the issue of related parties is really a red herring here, because in and of itself, it's irrelevant as to determining whether or not a sale is conducted at arm's length. Did the parties act at arm's length? For example, if I decide to sell my property to my daughter, we're related, but if I either get, let's say I get an appraisal and we use the independent appraisal price, the fact that we were related is irrelevant. We acted at arm's length by getting an independent appraisal.
Well, but didn't the record show that there were not independent appraisals here in conjunction with the sale?
I don't know if there were independent appraisals, but there was clear negotiation and clear values established. The document was signed. Nothing changed. Then the fellow went to work for him. That's all they have. That's nothing, because the parties acted independently.
Well, let me ask you a question.
Yes.
Let me ask you a question about the record, too, about this Reynoldsburg case that apparently was settled when it came to this court. The record of that case was made a part of the cases that we're talking about today.
I think they were all joined together at the BOR because there were nine different properties. And by the way, there's no testimony as to what, if any of the properties involved in any of those hearings were the ones that my esteemed adversary pointed to as something that Mr. Jergen had some interest in. We have no idea which particular property that was. I assume had it been one of these, they would have mentioned it. But
well, there was testimony, though, in that Reynoldsburg case that from the a person who testified, who was with the, I guess, the Ustorit, that it was extremely important part, the non-compete and all of that was an extremely essential part of the sale transaction. So doesn't that potentially affect its arm's length
Absolutely
character?
Absolutely not, because nothing changed. They negotiated the price. They did all that. They agreed, both the buyer and the seller, signed the contract. The price never changed. None of the terms changed. They acted at arm's length. The fact that the SEC requires a form to be filed, no matter how tenuous a relationship, without more, that you have to put down if there's any relationship after the transaction between the parties has nothing to do with this, because it had nothing to do with how the parties acted in negotiating this agreement.
Let me ask you, counsel suggested that sort of the legal issue here might be whether or not enough evidence was presented to shift the burden back to the school boards here. Picking up on your hypothetical, if there were a sale between a person and the person's daughter, say, wouldn't the evidence of that relationship be enough to then put the burden on the other side to say, well, in spite of the fact, it's still an arm's length transaction?
Well, their evidence was perfect on showing it was an arm's length transaction. The document is signed and executed. Nothing has changed thereafter. Then the fella goes to work for him. What more do you need to say? I mean, that's the facts speak for themselves. That's the end of it. You don't need any more.
So the Form 10-Q disclosure of related party is completely insignificant or even irrelevant, totally irrelevant.
Not irrelevant, but insignificant, because the parties acted at arm's length. And to solely rely on that is just like me saying, hey, we're related, throw the sale out. Well, what are the facts in relation to this? Before you signed the document, did you guys agree on a price before this guy was even working for you? Oh, yeah, we settled that. We agreed on a price. Everything was established. Then afterwards, because we didn't want to screw up the project, we brought somebody on board who knew something about it to run it for us.
But wasn't the guy actually the principal of the entity that sold, that was the seller?
That's
in the
right.
06 sale?
He was the principal. Doesn't matter. He acted at arm's length because they negotiated a price, they settled on it, and that was the end of it. All these facts are in the record. They don't need any more. They testified to it. They proved it. They proved that this was an arm's length sale. The date, April 3rd, 2006, that's when they signed it. The guy came to work for him April 24th or 26th. Dispositive. Then they talk about, they raise issues about the allocation of value. The value of each of the nine properties, as we indicated, was in the sale price, in the document, in the agreement that was executed on April 3rd. If they think that the burden shifted to us, they're incorrect. Under the First Cal case, once that has happened, once you present the contract, the burden's on the owner then to prove why that allocation wasn't sufficient. And here, of course, they didn't. So it's our contention, Your Honor, that first of all, they waived everything because they had nothing in their one paragraph brief. But even if they'd had a great brief like they did at the Supreme Court with all the major issues, the ones they neglected to put in their BTA brief, but even had they done that at the BTA, this is a simple arm's length sale. Document executed, independent board on the buyer side approves it, having nothing to do with this guy who then became an employee. Therefore, do not become a super BTA. This decision is not unreasonable, it is not unlawful, and should not be reversed. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Rich. Mr. Gill, you have reserved 58 seconds for rebuttal.
Thank you. Thank you. My esteemed colleague is taking a leap of faith to look at the First Cal and talk about allocation. I think we first have to talk about the arm's length nature of the sale before we get to that point. And it's conjecture to talk about whether or not there was negotiation or movement back and forth. None of that is in the record. The only thing that's in the record is the purchase and sale agreement, which includes a non-compete as part of and a condition precedent. I think that shifts the burden of the proving of the arm's length nature of the sale to the other side. They have plenty of time to research that and find out about these issues and then talk about First Cal. We didn't get there. There's nothing else in the record. We required nothing more than a paragraph at the Board of Tax Appeals, and all of our issues were already in the record at the Board of Revision. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Gill. This case will be submitted, and the court will advise the parties of its decision.
Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This open session of the Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio now stands adjourned. Thank you.
Thanks, you.
Steve, nice dealing with you, man. Have a safe journey.